Good evening and welcome to the local news. Today is Wednesday, February 12th. I'm Lauren Schmidt reporting for KMUD. In tonight's news, North Coast sees 600 aftershocks following December magnitude 7 earthquake. County conversation with Humboldt's second district supervisor. And Mendocino Board of Supervisors to revisit limits on public comment. Stay tuned, news on those stories and more coming right up. High winds, high surf, and heavy mountain snow are all predicted over the next few days. We go to the National Weather Service in Eureka for more.
Yes, hello. My name is Danny Schmiegel. I'm a meteorologist with the National Weather Service here based in Eureka. We're definitely going to see a change to our weather coming up within the next few hours and kind of through the next 48 as well. So that's going to start with some rain. We can actually currently see some rain coming onshore from the Pacific Ocean right now, and this will last through about Friday morning. So we're going to get a little bit of rain tonight, some lingering showers overnight as well, and then definitely a heavier burst of rain tomorrow morning before finally kind of fizzling out through the rest of Thursday and Friday early morning. So what we can expect with that is about 1 to 3 inches of rain total. For lots of the areas that are populated within Del Norte and Humboldt and northern Mendocino counties. So about 1 to 3 inches. Up at the higher terrains and within some mountainous areas, definitely expect some more, probably 3 to 5 inches or so. And in addition to that rain coming through, there's definitely also going to be some gustier winds. It looks like the higher elevations right now will have wind gusts at around 35 to 40 miles per hour with a peak gust of 50 possible. But the more coastal headland areas and kind of populated centers will see gusts of about 25 to 30 miles per hour. So it'll be gusty, but nothing too crazy. In addition to that, we also have a winter storm warning for Trinity County. So it looks like parts of Trinity County that are above 2,000 feet can expect about 2 to 4 inches of snow. In addition, we have some higher snow amounts possible for the Trinity Horn. Those higher elevations are definitely seeing about 1 to 1.5 feet of snow up in Scott Mountain Pass, in addition to the Alps, which shows almost 36 inches of snow coming through. So it's going to be a wet system coming into our area these next couple hours.
Friday morning, those along the coast are advised to avoid the beaches due to the high surf advisory.
So it might be a nice day to look at the waves instead of trying to walk along the shores. Stay away from high beaches, don't turn your back to the ocean, and make sure that everyone stays safe on that Valentine's Day morning.
A flood advisory is also in effect for southern Mendocino County. You can see a map of the warnings, watches, and advisories for the North Coast online at weather.gov/EKA. A magnitude 4.5 earthquake was one of 8 recent aftershocks that rattled the North Coast, the most seismically active region in the contiguous United States. This sequence is a result of the large earthquake that struck at the end of 2024.
That's right. So everybody remembers what happened on December 5th. We had a magnitude 7 earthquake roughly 40 miles off of Cape Mendocino.
That was Lori Dangler, Professor Emeritus of Geology at Cal Poly Humboldt, widely regarded as the local earthquake expert.
And since then, we have had, let's see, my last count was 624 aftershocks of magnitude 1 and larger.
Although 600 aftershocks may seem like a large number, Dangler says it's pretty typical.
Magnitude 7 is considered a major earthquake. It's a big quake. It moved roughly 35 to 40 mile long section of fault where the rocks on either side were displaced on the order of several feet. And in the main earthquake, it didn't all rupture smoothly the same amount. Some patches moved a little more than others. And there's always stress at the ends because you're going from an area that slipped to one that didn't.
As a result, smaller seismic events are common.
Aftershocks are nature's way of kind of readjusting things.
The North Coast saw hundreds of aftershocks in the first few weeks following the magnitude 7 earthquake. While they are continuing to decrease over time, the largest aftershock in the sequence, a magnitude 5.3, occurred a week later.
And since then, it's kind of a stable period for aftershocks. We'll have a couple of days with very few, or maybe only one or two, and then we'll have days where we have 7 or 8. And one of those days happened to be yesterday. So we had 8 aftershocks recorded, including 2 that were in the magnitude 4 range, a 4.1 and a 4.5. And I know quite a few people felt that 4.5, and a fair number felt the 4.1.
But Dangler reassures that there is nothing unusual or unexpected about these aftershocks.
I mean, this is just think of nature trying to settle things back into a new state of equilibrium. We're quite likely to have more magnitude 4s. The USGS puts just under a 50% likelihood that we'll have another 4 in the next month. There's also a small chance that we could have something even larger. They put it at about a 6% chance of a magnitude 5 in the next month, and roughly 20% chance of a magnitude 5 over the next year. So aftershock sequences last a long time. And with a magnitude 7, I would expect we will continue to have aftershocks for probably another year.
As for how you know when the aftershock sequence is over,
when we're back to what the normal rate of activity on that fault was before that magnitude 7. And the Mendocino Fault is arguably the most active fault in the state of California. If you measure it by the number of magnitude 4 or larger earthquakes that occur each year, San Andreas does not produce as many magnitude 4 or larger earthquakes as the Mendocino Fault. And so it's just pumping out these magnitude 3s, 4s, 5s, some 6s, and occasional 7.
Notably, earthquakes cannot be predicted, nor can their severity. However, scientists are able to analyze historic data.
We don't think it's going to produce anything a whole lot larger than what we just experienced. In 1994, there was a 7.2. That's probably about as large an earthquake as we would expect to have on the Mendocino Fault. And what we experienced on December 5th was the part closest to the coast, sort of the 40 miles just offshore of Cape Mendocino. That was the most likely to feel shaking on land. So if we were to have another 7 in the near future, which is certainly possible, it would be most likely further offshore and wouldn't be felt as strongly.
While this fault may not experience another large earthquake in the near future,
we have plenty of other faults that could produce an entirely different earthquake sequence at any time.
The possibility of a magnitude 9 Cascadia subduction zone earthquake is slim, but not impossible. It is considered by experts to be one of the most dangerous earthquake faults in the world. Where smaller earthquakes can shake for seconds, a magnitude 9 would shake for minutes, likely triggering tsunamis along the entire northwest coast. Which is why Dangler says it is critical to prepare.
Well, I like to point people to our Living on Shaky Ground magazine. And I believe you've got a link to it on your website, but you can certainly always look at the digital version online at the Redwood Coast Tsunami Workgroup webpage, or you can call the geology department at Cal Poly Humboldt, and we're happy to send you a copy.
You can find a copy of Living on Shaky Ground on our website, as well as a photo of the recent earthquake activity at KMUD.org. In this edition of County Conversations, our monthly check-in with Humboldt County Supervisors, we speak with Michelle Bushnell, who represents Humboldt's 2nd District. This district includes the cities and unincorporated towns along the 101 corridor from Benbow to Fortuna, and stretches east to west from Bridgeville to Shelter Cove. Supervisor Bushnell shared updates on Humboldt County's budget, the decommissioning plan for the two dams on the main stem Eel River, and Measure O. Supervisor Bushnell, good afternoon, and thank you for joining us. You are now about a month into your role as chair of the Humboldt County Board of Supervisors. Can you start by sharing an overview of how your responsibilities have evolved in this position and what your experience has been like so far?
First of all, thank you to KMUD, and being chair really is mostly about just organizing the meeting and keeping the flow going. It's not really to, you know, corral the supervisors, so to say, but I have to sign documents and I help with setting the agenda up. And then during the meeting, you know, I help to keep the flow going. And I've done a little process change just to make that flow a little better. I have hearings going in the morning and staff presentations going in the morning so that they can get back to their job and not have to hang out in chambers all day. And it has its challenges as far as I have to use my mind a lot during the meeting to keep the organization and the flow going. So I really have to concentrate on, you know, my agenda during the weekend and writing down the points that I need to make for my district and asking my questions on paper, having them down on paper so that I can remember everything. That really is about it in a nutshell for the chair position.
At yesterday's meeting, there was discussion about the county's ongoing budget deficits and the need for stricter spending controls in the next budget cycle. Given the financial challenges ahead, what do you see as the most pressing fiscal concerns and what strategies are being considered to address them?
Sure. So the financial challenges are that we don't have enough money in our fund balance to keep funding departments at a deficit. And so we've asked for, the CAO came forward and asked the supervisors for a status quo budget, meaning no additional funding requests from departments. So they will be given a budget amount, which will be the same as last year. Although almost every department, I think there were three that didn't have an additional request, had additional requests. So they utilized their budget to, you know, zero and then had to come to the board and ask for more money. So we're not going to be allowing that this year. And in turn, that'll mean cuts in departments because they're not bringing enough revenue to run their departments. So that also projects out into the community as services. Most all departments are service departments for the county. And so I anticipate that, you know, the county special unincorporated areas will be filling that in the next fiscal year.
Transitioning to the Potter Valley project, there is a new water diversion agreement involving 7 parties, but Humboldt County is not one of them, even though much of the affected river flows through the 2nd District. Can you provide some background on your role in the ad hoc committee representing the county and share your perspective on this agreement?
Yeah. I don't know if most people know, but through the FERC process, PG&E is going to be taking out both Cape Horn Dam and the other Scotts Valley Dam. I anticipate those contracts will be signed in early July, and so a hopeful dam removal will start happening 26-27. We have not been included in the new makeup of the high water diversions that are going to happen for Mendocino and Sonoma. Equally, Lake hasn't been involved, and neither has Glenn, and they receive waters from those. What we have been involved in with myself and Supervisor Wilson is being very stern on, we're not going to be okay with this if there is not money coming in for restoration, and also leading to eventually no high water diversions in the future. That future looking about 30 years down the road, but mainly getting money for restoration yearly. So we were able, they originally came to us and said, we'll give you $250,000 for restoration on the Ill River, which is 80 miles into Humboldt County, the Ill River. And that was not okay. That's a joke. You can't do anything with $250,000. So we were able to get that money up to $750,000 to $1 million a year, which, can be utilized to secure a grant if you have matching funds, or to get that work done, to get that those grants. And so that'll be a 30-year contract. Additionally, there are going to be some restoration monies, around $16 million that come in to start that process, and then that $750,000 to $1 million each year. While I can say my board largely yesterday are not happy about the diversions that are still going to happen, it is an improvement to get those dams out and get the majority of that water coming down. And the high water diversions will only happen during the highest of waters. And if we have a drought, there won't be any diversions. And so that's a vast improvement to what we have right now, which is nothing.
Can you expand on how this is a starting point for restoration efforts in the Eel River, and how the county is planning to advocate for funding to support these initiatives?
Sure. So the county statement in whole is to remove the dams and have no diversion. Now, it's not a perfect scenario with the high water diversions, but it's an improvement of what we, for 100 years, that water has been diverted out of the Eel River. Restoration looks like we have a pike minnow problem that really impacts the, our fisheries on our water. And so that, and restorating the Ill River so that we can have a healthy fish population in the future, is number one for Humboldt County. What that restoration process looks like, we're not sure, like, who will administer that. I know that the county our intent is only to lobby for the monies to get the restoration going. We envision some outside agency, you know, Friends of the Ill River, or, you know, there's like three agencies already, nonprofits that work towards that. And so I imagine they would be heavily engaged with that. And we're hopeful that they'll take that work on.
And in closing, anything else you would like to highlight for our listeners?
Sure. So we had a Measure O discussion. As folks will remember, Measure O is the 1% sales tax that's going to be happening start April 1st. That is for county roads and some money's going to public transit. At today's economy, which is terrible, we anticipate getting around $24 million a year for updating our county roads. We have a process that is happening now to decide what percentage of money will go to public transit, what will go to county roads. That will be an ad hoc of Supervisor Madrone and Supervisor Wilson. After that ad hoc, along with Tom Matson and representatives from transit and representatives from the Builders Exchange and the builders people. So then that recommendation will come to our board. And once that happens, then Director Ford will bring us a slate of projects that need to happen in Humboldt County. But the most important is we want to get pavement on the ground and get these roads fixed up. I do anticipate that the Garberville Complete Streets project, which has been number one on Tom Matson's list, Director Matson's list, will be getting some of that money that we can put towards matching some grants or matching maybe federal state dollars to get the Garberville Streets project going. And then if I have one more minute, I'd just like to encourage the community to reach out to me if you're having issues, want to know where my thoughts are, where the budget's at, just any questions at all. My phone number's out there and my email's out there. I'm happy to meet or talk with anybody. I answer my phone, so if you want to give me a call, I can answer your question.
That was Supervisor Michelle Bushnell speaking during our monthly check-in. County Conversations. You can tune in for our discussions with the 2nd District Supervisor on the second Wednesday of each month. If you have questions you would like us to ask, you can email them to news@kmud.org. Our next county conversation will be next Wednesday with 3rd District Supervisor Mike Wilson. Turning to Mendocino, the Board of Supervisors revisits limits on public comment. KZYX's Elise Cox spoke with one of the Mendocino supervisors to learn more.
We spoke with Board Chairman John Hashek about two issues that are very likely to generate substantial public comment. The first has to do with, well, public comment itself and how much the board should allow and at what point in the meeting.
In the rules of procedure for the board, there's always been this 10-minute rule for public expression on items not on the agenda. And so whether it's been enforced or not is, at the discretion of the chair. And some chairs have enforced it, but a lot of times it hasn't been enforced. And we've seen, meetings get the public expression go on for an hour, hour and a half, sometimes even 2 hours about items that sometimes we don't even have any power over. And so, to be consistent, I tried to start off the year enforcing the 10-minute rule for a single topic, all right? And so that was so that we don't have, the meeting starting 2 hours later and people, staff especially waiting around all that time for their item to come up. And so it's kind of trying to create more efficient meetings and yet at the same time respect and honor the public expression. And so how do we do that? And so I presented in the agenda summary that I'm offering for the agenda item to discuss this with the board because I want board buy-in on it. I don't want it just to be my decision, but rather make sure everyone's agreeing to it so that we have some support. And so what I'm offering are different options, but one that I came up with yesterday after meeting with some people was, what if we started public expression right after lunch? So maybe 1:30 at each board meeting. That way, if there's lots of comments, then it won't disrupt the whole morning business. And sometimes it could be the last item of the day. I've seen other boards do it that way, where the public expression is just the last item of the day. And so then that would take the pressure off enforcing the 10-minute rule also. So there's other, there's ideas out there about what to do with it, and I'm just looking for a path forward that, again, honors the public's right to express items or opinions about items not on the agenda, and also that respects the taxpayer money and runs the meeting efficiently.
The second topic has to do with the cannabis ordinance and whether it covers grows of 10,000 square feet or twice that size.
So it's this whole thing about the amount of cultivation size that people have and the doubling of the size with the reading of the plain reading of the ordinance. And that was done by, county council's office. And so that's been controversial. And when I brought it up to the board in October, there wasn't a decision made at that time. It was a 2-2 vote. And so now we have a new board, and I just think that it should be a board decision. And so that's part of what I'm trying to bring forward. And then also we have been hearing, about the taxes, about, expansion, about, other issues surround, micro businesses, all these issues around cannabis. And so I want that to be taken care of in the General Government Committee. That's where I was the chair for the last 2 years, and we dealt with a lot of the issues, and certainly there's issues that keep coming up. And so I want that to be a public discussion where everyone can be heard and move forward, you know. So hopefully the General Government Committee would bring back recommendations to the board about how to proceed on both, well, on the issue of the density issue or the cultivation size, whatever you want to call it, and also these other issues that I just outlined.
The board will also take up the topic of low-intensity camping. On the agenda is a request from the Planning Department for guidance on drafting an ordinance establishing low-intensity camping in inland areas. The guidance is necessary before the department can proceed with any stakeholder or public meetings. The Planning Department wants the board to clarify things like whether the board desires to have a minimum parcel requirement. Does the board desire to have a cap on the number of campsites per parcel? Does the board desire to have an on-site host requirement? Does the board desire to have minimum setback standards between campsites and either adjacent properties or dwellings beyond standard zoning setbacks? And does the board desire for regulations to have different permit requirements for sites located on private roads? For KZYX News, I'm Elise Cox.
In national news, the House Progressive Caucus blasts Elon Musk for illegal power grab and calls for his removal from government meddling. Teresa Wersbianska shares this report.
Fire Elon Musk.
That was head of the Progressive Caucus, Representative Greg Kassar, Democrat from Texas. He and a group from the Congressional Progressive Caucus denounced Elon Musk and his self-styled Department of Government Efficiency. They say the billionaire's infiltration into multiple federal agencies is an illegal power grab.
An unelected, unaccountable billionaire now has seemingly unlimited powers over Americans' private data and over Americans' taxpayer dollars.
Kassar, who is chair of the caucus, said the group would use any legislative or judicial tool to have him removed from government affairs. Musk and his associates have expanded their influence to various government agencies, including the U.S. Agency for International Development, the Department of Education, the Office of Personnel Management, and the Treasury Department. Maxine Dexter from Oregon says all Americans should be alarmed.
In the last week alone, Elon Musk has seized control of the U.S. Department of Treasury's payment system, exposing Americans' most personal financial information, has shuttered the U.S. Agency for International Aid, USAID, putting the lives of millions of people at risk across the world, and threatened the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, undermining our work to combat the climate crisis. This is just the start.
According to a report from the Wall Street Journal this week, DOGE representatives have also gained access to critical payment and contracting systems at the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services, where they are actively investigating potential fraud within agency payment systems. New York Representative Nydia Velazquez says Musk's infiltration, supported by the executive branch, violates Article 1 of the Constitution by taking governance powers away from elected legislators.
You see, what really frustrates me, that the Speaker of the House doesn't have the courage to stand up and defend the integrity of the legislative branch.
Musk supporters say his slash and burn tactics to supposedly root out waste and corruption are within the rights of the executive branch. House Speaker Republican Mike Johnson spoke to reporters Thursday.
So we don't see this as a threat to Article 1 at all. We see this as an active, engaged, committed executive branch authority doing what the executive branch should do.
Musk's DOGE, named for a digital currency, is a cabinet-level department that is not a department at all. The White House says Musk is a special government employee who can legally work for 130 days per year on government projects. This exempts him, says the White House, from regular ethics and disclosure rules. Legal efforts to stop Doge have abounded this week. Attorneys general from several states vowed to file a lawsuit to stop Musk from accessing federal payroll systems. A federal judge will consider Friday whether to block him from accessing systems at the Labor Department, which has investigated the billionaire's companies. I'm Teresa Wierzbianska, Pacifica Radio, KPFA.
That's all for tonight's broadcast. Thank you for listening. Thanks to our engineer, Larry Lashley. And thanks to our reporters, Elise Cox and Teresa Wierzbianska. Reporting from our studio in Redway, I'm Lauren Schmidt.